So,
also feel free to give me more details if you think at any point. I'll also give you some hints from my previous interviews, whatever I heard, so that you can also think about those answers and give me if, in your opinion, are they correct or.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your current role here and since when?
So I'm here at Leap since about 3 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And my main role is product owner and business developer.
What does it mean, business developer?
So it's a mix of extending the business activities as well as regular sale activities.
So you have to talk to customers.
Yeah, exactly. And we like to, not everybody does it, but we like to mix both roles so that you don't have this typical scenario where the salesperson makes promises and then hands it over to the project team and then it's not his problem anymore. So yeah, that's
good.
What I do.
How many years of experience you have with software development or mobile development?
Well, software development as a product owner or product manager, mm-hmm. I have about 10 years now.
10 years.
But I've only done mobile since I'm here at Leap, so mobile mm-hmm. specifically would be 3 years.
3 years, yeah.
Yes.
And how many years of experience you have with this kind of gathering requirements from clients?
I think that extends more than the mm-hmm. past 10 years actually, because
mm-hmm.
I've been working as a project manager and things like that mm-hmm. also previously, so yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. I have to think hard, but 10 plus
for sure. What's your academic background? So you come from software engineering or
yeah, well, I would say I come more from the technical side, even
mm-hmm.
if I broke off my studies. So
mm-hmm.
I started IT
mm-hmm.
at DPFL in Lausanne, but I didn't finish,
mm-hmm.
and then I just started working.
But you have that background of computers.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Correct. Whatever techniques you must be using with your clients, be it workshops or whatever, how did you learn those and where? Or is it through experience, self-taught?
Mostly, but not only. It's through working experience actually,
right.
Mostly, and reading and things
reading.
Like that.
So, what do you read exactly? Do you read online blogs? Articles?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. I mostly read. Blogs, testimonials from
people. Do you also
read
any scientific publications or journals?
Not regarding requirements engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great. Let's talk about your company a little bit. How many employees do you have here?
So we have 180 employees. Yes.
And
they don't all do mobile.
Right, but these are all the strength of the company. So
yes.
All the people. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And which are the geographical markets you build for your app?
Switzerland.
Only Switzerland?
Only Switzerland, yeah.
Okay.
Well, not of course the market of the app itself can be.
Could but your clients are from here.
The clients are Swiss, yeah, exactly, are from Switzerland because we like to have the proximity
mm-hmm.
with the customer.
Customers, yeah.
Yes.
I suppose you have other offices also. You also
mm.
have in Fribourg, right? In what?
Fribourg, Zurich, St. Gallen, Lausanne, Bern.
Okay.
Yeah, so we have five offices.
Five offices.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the purposes? So there are development centers or sales centers? Or
no, they're all generalists, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of having five locations and not one is not an economical one because it's less efficient economically. It's really to have proximity
with the
customers.
Client.
Because we like to, I mean, we do video conferencing and stuff like that when we need to, but we like to
have
an on-site presence. And
so it's important.
Yes, that's the reason why.
Do you have any number? How many mobile apps have you built so far?
No, I would say, good question. I guess about 20-ish, yeah. We only do mobile app, so really native mobile app development at Leap since four or five years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite new for Leap, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And out of these 20 apps, so are they enterprise apps or are they public apps?
It's a mix of both.
Mix
I would
both.
Say mostly public apps.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just a couple of enterprise apps.
And the public apps, are they free?
Yeah, I think there is none that is paying. Yeah, I think they're all free. Yeah.
They are available on Play Stores.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you tell me roughly average users your apps might have?
The number of users?
Mm-hmm. Or you can also tell me like this. So which app has the least number of users, which has the most number of users, roughly also.
Yeah, well, it's hard to tell honestly. I would say probably the least amount of users would be like 200 users, something like that. And that would be an enterprise app I'm thinking about, because that's contained into the enterprise itself.
Right.
And the most, it's a good question, something between 10 or 20,000 users.
20,000?
Yeah.
Great. So I suppose your language official would be different in different regions, right? I mean, in different offices of communication within the teams.
Yes.
Might be Swiss, Deutsch, or Swiss German, or maybe French.
Exactly. This is going to ruin your recording.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. It depends. Well, it not only depends on the location, it depends on the composition of the team also. Because you might have people, teams in Zurich where some people are not German speaking, so they would then speak English. And
okay.
Yeah. But it's we tend to speak a lot of English, but when we can, we speak the local languages.
Mm-hmm. I suppose you don't just build mobile apps, you also build software in general.
We as Leap, yes. We build, well, not really, we don't build software in the sense of Java apps or things like that. We're coming from the world of web development.
Mm-hmm.
That's really where Leap got started, and then extended to mobile apps, but also other services like service design or general user experience, services, data services, things like that are extended.
Right. Could you tell me like which platforms do you support? iOS, Android, both?
Both. Yeah, exactly. So I'm struggling. Yeah, maybe I think we have one app which we have only built only for one platform, but all the other apps we kind of always built for both Android and iOS.
Who
we haven't done any
decision?
Windows phones or stuff like
Who
that.
Who makes the decision? Is it you or the client?
Well, it's the client, of course, because the client is the one deciding what he finally wants to build. But it's not really a big question most of the times, because as most apps are public and consumer focused, you need to address both platforms.
But do you suggest them platform which they can use if they do not have any idea?
Yeah, we would do that. Yeah.
On which factors would it depend?
Well, it depends on what the app is intended for and what's the audience. But I don't really see a case here, at least here in Switzerland, where we would have a consumer app which would say you would only build for one of the two platforms. I have a hard time imagining what that use case would be.
Also, would you build for the both platforms at the same time, or one comes first?
We have done both. We mostly do in the same time, but we have done a couple of times building, I think it was on iOS first, and then, you know, to just invest that effort before really testing it on users properly, and then build on Android. We've done that also a couple of times, but most times we build both at the same time.
And could you give me roughly estimation of the distribution, which is more preferred, which is...
By the users, you mean, or
by the clients, also by the users.
Well, by the clients, I can't really tell. It's really because, as I said, most say they want both platforms, so there's no preference there. And well, by the users, it's the typical mix. In Switzerland, is quite iOS heavy.
iOS heavy. Mm. I heard the same. Great. Does it involve economical factors to go with only one platform at the beginning and then add another? Or it doesn't really matter for your clients so far?
It's often a thought of investing, because when they are aware that you don't just build software and then it comes out exactly as intended and it addresses the public exactly as intended, when that awareness is there, that's the driver for that wish to build on one platform first. Kind of, they think it's half the effort, and then you can test and correct, and then once you know exactly what works, you will do it for the other platform. So it's an economical driver for sparing development effort.
So if you are offering the same application on both platforms, would it be a case that you offer different features on different platforms?
Not different
just
features.
Just because the platform offers you some technical advantages over the other.
I can't see any case where we've done that. It, of course, the usability or the UX can be a bit different because we try to stay with the known paradigmas from each platform, which may differ. But feature-wise...
I'll give you an example. So one of the companies I interviewed, he said they were building an app for virtual reality related things, and they just realized that the libraries for iOS, I think, which is VRKit, was not so adequately developed or mature as compared to what is available for Android. So they decided to go for that app with Android. So it depended on certain other factors, the capability what the platform offers. Yes.
We haven't really encountered
never
such
encountered
a limitation.
Any such right. So are you a product-oriented company or are you service-based?
We are service-based.
You're service-based, right? So in that case, imagine the moment when you have a customer and the moment he starts giving you ideas until you have your first product release, how much time does it take? So it will depend, of course, on the projects, but on an average, like what is the least?
Or so from the question is from the time we first have contact with the customer,
right,
or from the time we really have had the kickoff with the...
Maybe like the kickoff.
Yeah, because you have the lead time
for
contracts.
Correct.
And I don't think that's what's the point. So supposing that we would start working directly and we don't have any other external constraints, it can go quite fast. Usually we have a sprint of we do 2 week sprints most of the times, and usually we have the first sprint. You can't really say you have deliverable that you could push to users even for testing at that point. Most times you need 2 sprints. So after a month, you start having things that you can really test on.
But
users.
Would that month also include gathering requirements?
No, that would be really be no. That would be really just developing. And the point is, often we have customers who come to us and they come too late, in my opinion. So they come and they already have preconceived ideas of what they want, and I want an app with a red button in the corner.
In your opinion, is it a good thing or bad thing?
No, I think it's a bad thing.
It's a bad thing?
Yeah. Because it's the requirement engineering part is quite lacking at the customer, and the whole marketing part is often also quite lacking. So they often don't really know who their customers
but
are.
I would ask you also this way. So would it also matter in this case if the client has some technical background and if he comes with an idea compared to the client who has no idea, have no technical background and he comes with an idea? So
it's not the technical part that's the problem. It's the knowing the customer part that's the problem.
Okay, so they do not know their end users.
Yeah.
All right, I get it. So how typically teams in your company look like for mobile development?
So we typically have a smaller development team. We won't have like 10 mobile devs working at once because the code base is usually smaller, so we don't want to step on the feet of each other. So we usually have maybe 2 developers, like typically an iOS and an Android developer, and then maybe a backend developer, so that'd be 2 or 3 developers. Sometimes we have 4 developers when we have to get going a bit. And we have a UX designer.
UX designer also, okay.
And the UX designer, as well as the product owner, of course, which is also in the team, and Scrum Master. Product owner and UX designer are the ones involved really in the requirements part.
How about testers? You have?
No, we don't have a dedicated testing department or things like that.
Do you outsource testing or quality?
Well, it's done by the developers.
Mm-hmm.
So when the developers or the definition of done is that it's quality tested as well.
Okay. How about deployments? Do you have any deployment engineers?
No, we have.
So developers can take care of it.
Yeah, exactly. So we have the whole pipeline automated.
You also do not outsource any design work?
No.
You have everything in-house?
Mm-hmm.
So I would say a typical team would look like 5-6 people on an average.
Yeah, something like that.
Right.
Probably more around 5 and 6. I mean, it's mostly smaller teams.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So in which phases of your project are the customers involved? Is it throughout? Is it in the beginning?
It's mostly as a, well, the customers, so the end customers, the users of the product, you mean, not our customers, because that's the crux. Our customers are most times, if it's not an internal app, are not the users of the app.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have really lacking contacts with the end users.
Mm-hmm.
And where in good cases where the customer is open to the idea that we need to do proper requirements engineering and all that, we might have contacts, sporadic contacts with users in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
When we would talk about user journeys and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would love to have, you know, a user test group looking at every release after each sprint and really testing it. But sadly, that doesn't happen. Mostly never happens. So even we do agile developments, we don't submit the releases to the real users.
Just to the beta users.
Yeah. Well, that would be good. But
that doesn't happen. Also.
The users mostly aren't the real users. Mostly are our customer and thing
okay.
and people at our customers, which are already having this tunnel vision because they've been okay. thinking about it and working on the project a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem we would like to solve, but it's hard thing to do. So most of the times it's only when we then have had a public non-beta release. That the real users will get in touch with it, and even then, it's hard to convince the customers that we need to do user research or user testing or things like that, interviewing or whatever to really get some feedback from the real users. So there is a lot to do in that area. Yeah.
Great. So if your client has some expertise with software development, some experience, would you think that will influence your work in a good or bad way?
Yeah, it probably will. Not really. I don't know if your question is still focused around requirements gathering.
Yes.
Well, yeah. It really depends on what that experience is. If it's the classical waterfall experience, then that might not help because they might think that's the way to go because they've done that for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
If it's experience involving really user-centric approaches, then well, of course that would help.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
because
it's
I heard that people said if the customer is coming from a technical background, it is easier to communicate. The communication also takes less time.
Mm-hmm. We really try to stay user-centric as much as we can.
Mm-hmm.
The communication with the customer is mostly based around what the user wants and what we think he wants and all that. And the customer doesn't really have to bother that much with the technical details. That's our job.
Great.
So, no, we don't
that's
really encounter that.
Yeah. I have a few questions about security and legal things, but I think we can talk to them afterwards. So, if you consider the project lifespan of the project, what percentage of it, in terms of time and cost, would you spend on requirements engineering activities? Roughly.
So less than we want. And yeah, let me think here. I think it's maybe around 15-20
yep.
percent, something like that, I would say. Yeah.
And could you tell me why does it happen?
Why it's so low, or why we do it at all?
I wouldn't say low necessarily, but what are the challenges in that context? For instance, what I've heard from other people is the customers usually do not want to pay for these
exactly.
particular things.
That's definitely one challenge. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. The customers, even though it often turns out they didn't really know what their customers wanted exactly, they usually think they do.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not really open to being challenged often because they think they are coming to a company like Leap or another one for the really technical expertise on how to build the software.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I said before, they often come a bit too late.
Too
so
late,
decisions
yeah.
have already been made, they have already thought about it internally, and they do some sort of requirement engineering, I guess, but not really the new way of doing things, really.
Correct.
Testing, you know, beforehand with.
Is it easier to convince them about these new ways?
No, that's.
Do you try?
Yeah, every time.
Yeah.
And no, it's really a tough process.
I guess so. Could you describe me how the process looks like?
So what we would like to do, or what we finally end up doing?
Finally end up doing, perhaps.
So.
And also, you can talk afterwards. What we would you like to do in that?
So typically, we start off. It depends. If we get in early, we can already do workshops where we discuss the vision. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the vision can be really rough, and it can end up just, you know, we have a workshop with a couple of brainstorming sessions where we formulate something like, for this and that group, mm-hmm. we would like to achieve this and that business goal, mm-hmm. and therefore we will build a mobile app in our case, or maybe not. Mm-hmm. Which should, and then we have some key points, so really something really rough. And then, but that we don't do very often, because that would be very early in the process.
So do you decide during brainstorming which platform you want to go? Is it web or mobile?
Yeah, exactly. And maybe the outcome could even be they need to do a marketing advertisement campaign, and then it's not Leap at all. I mean, that could not necessarily end up in us having mm-hmm. to work for the customer in the end.
Right.
But that's okay. And but mostly they come to us because they already sense they need mm-hmm. something. So that doesn't happen very often. Often the first point is we will define personas. Mm-hmm. So the customer would come and would already have a business case in mind or use case in mind. And so then we would define personas. And we would do that together with the customer who knows his customer better than mm-hmm. we do, of course. But we would love to do it and then yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But we most of times it's out of the imagination of the customer. We then proceed to discuss and elaborate the user journey.
Mm-hmm.
Does that talk to you, or do you want me to explain a bit what I understand by user journey?
Maybe you can talk about it. So I have a rough idea.
Mm? Okay. So.
But I think every company does it in a different way.
Yeah, probably, exactly. So well, at Leap, for you to understand, we're self-organized completely. Mm-hmm. We don't have any management.
Mm-hmm.
And so it might be that we, in my circle, as we call it, do things differently than maybe here or in Zurich.
Okay.
But, yeah. User journey, well, as we understand it, is really the steps that the user has to take for one of the use cases, one of the business mm-hmm. goals, to achieve what the person wants. So. Let's say we have a web and e-commerce or something, and so we would imagine, you know, a user journey like, okay, I come. It can start by how do I find, you know, the site, mm-hmm. and I'm Googling maybe and stuff like that, and I want to buy a pair of trousers or something like that, and
so imagine a complete scenario.
Exactly, and the steps that you really have to take, you at mm-hmm. some point you have to decide about color, at some point you have to, mm-hmm. you know, decide about size, at some point the price may be important, maybe the brand and stuff like that. So we reflect on those steps, and that's not technical at all at that point. That's mm-hmm. really what the user needs to do. Maybe if it's in a physical store or on the internet,
mm-hmm.
that's really what we focus on. And then, so we have a combination of the user journey with the persona.
How do you record these things?
So most of times we do it on a wall somewhere with post-its, or we write on walls and stuff like that, because we like to have really as less constraints as possible, to let the imagination mm-hmm. flow. So that's where typically it's important that we meet with the customer and we have physically the customer here, or we are at the customer. And then that's also something that's suboptimal, because most times you end up with a wall full of post-its and stuff like that, and then you take a picture, or maybe you put up some big paper sheets and you stick the post-its on it, and then you have to roll that stuff up, and then you can imagine that it's hard to maintain.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Right.
It's really a great way to be free and express the ideas, but then it's really hard to maintain that mm-hmm. documentation. So that's a big problem we have. But that's the way we do it now. And so you have that, and then we would, of course, this doesn't happen in one session, all of this,
mm-hmm.
because it would be too much.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point we do a user story mapping.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when we start to reflect about, okay, for this and that step in the user journey, what features
right.
would
so
support.
So it goes
that.
Into technical details.
Yeah.
More.
Not really technical,
or the design
really.
Details.
Yeah, more design. Exactly. But that's where the user stories pop up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I would describe, okay, the user needs to be able to this and that,
mm-hmm.
and how do we facilitate or enable these activities? And then it flows from there, and at some point in the combination of the user journeys and the user stories from the mapping, where we also decide what's the, you know, the MVP and what is
mm-hmm.
refinement, the UX designer would then make mock-ups and you know, maybe a clickable prototype if it's needed. So we can quickly test the ideas, then we would test them. And again, that's where it would be really nice to have contact with the real end users,
mm-hmm.
but mostly we don't. So, but I mean, if it's a typical consumer app, we can pick people, you know, we know,
mm-hmm.
and, but the problem is we're, of course, here all biased towards a
right.
technologically savvy person, so that's not really representative, but, you know,
yes.
it's better than nothing anyway.
Right.
So we do UX critique, and we test those things out, and of course, always in discussion with the customer. Yeah, and then we develop, and also what's a bit hard is the agile development together with this UX
mm-hmm.
process, because that's quite waterfallish.
Because
mm-hmm. you look at the whole process, you try to think of its coherence,
mm-hmm.
but then you want to develop in an agile way and not already be set on exactly what you're going to do. So that's still a bit of a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
We try to not go too far into details.
Mm-hmm.
And we usually have the UX designer working a sprint ahead of the development team.
Mm-hmm.
So we do like small increments on the UX part as well. And then it's agile,
mm-hmm.
classical agile development.
How many, let's say, your customers participate in these activities or in this process?
So it's mostly the product owner on the side of the customer, and maybe somebody from marketing, if that's not the product owner himself
mm-hmm.
or herself. And eventually, if the customer has a designer in house, which is also involved, then so it's 1, 2, 3 people, not
one
more. And the problem is often you have hidden stakeholders, which are really hard to get out of the woods, which then
mm-hmm.
kind of influence the whole design without having been in the workshops, and that's a bit problematic.
Have you ever noticed that your customers, they face some challenges with this process?
But for the most of them, it's really new to think of it that way and to use these tools.
Mm-hmm.
But they often actually really appreciate it, and they like it, and they come out of it, and they thank us for all that, and they didn't expect all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mostly positive, actually. But it's hard for them, because they're not used to doing that.
Also from the time perspective, so it demands more time?
Yes. But that we tell them at the start right away, that the way we work is going to be more time consuming for them than
mm-hmm.
if they would just put, you know, a list of features to develop and then say come back in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's clear for them that it's not the way to go anymore, because they have no control, they're wary
mm-hmm.
about if it's going to be good or not. So,
right.
But they know that from the start. Yeah.
How do you communicate with them? Is it digital? Is it face-to-face? You said you already like to be close to your customers.
Yeah, exactly. As much as possible, we like to meet in person, but of course you won't do that for a daily stand-up.
Right.
It depends on also how involved the customer is. Some are really participating in every daily,
mm-hmm.
and some are not. So we use Slack a lot.
So your customers are also in Slack?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we have them as external users in our Slack most of the time. So they're really integrated in our, because that's our main communication
mm-hmm.
tool internally for direct messaging. Slack, we have a High Five, that's a video conferencing solution
mm-hmm.
which we use quite a lot, and that's quite a good one,
mm-hmm.
Really accessible to people who don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the phone, of course. But
do you see any challenges with communication?
It's the language is one often. It's not necessarily, often people are communicating in English, and it's not the native language of any of the participants.
But why does it happen? Because you are Swiss?
Yeah, because we have the team in Fribourg, we might still, even though we want to have proximity, we might still work
okay.
with clients in Zurich, which are German-speaking, and the devs are not really so German-speaking.
Okay.
So that's Switzerland, you know, we have four languages,
right.
but nobody really speaks those four languages.
So even your Swiss customers, you're talking in English?
Does happen, yeah, exactly.
Who is allowed to talk to customers?
Everybody.
Everybody.
And we try to I keep the ways short. The balance to find is short communication ways, so developers talking to the PO, the customer PO directly, but still having the leap PO involved so that it doesn't, you know, so that the information is not asymmetrical. So that's a bit of the challenge, but mostly we want to keep the ways short.
Even the developers, they are allowed to talk to customers?
Yeah.
Do you think it's a positive thing? It has some negative aspects as well?
I think it's 99% positive. Yeah.
Because I heard from the people, they said we like our developers to really focus on their work and not get distracted by unnecessary communication. But you don't see any such
No, because there. That depends on what the customer wants to communicate. And that's also a bit of a learning for the team, including the customer is included in the team. That's the way we work. So the customer PO is really part of the team.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's, you know, when it's technical stuff or maybe minor changes in requirements or use story or something like that, then there is no reason for the customer to go buy the product.
To the hierarchy.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just makes stuff harder. But when it's, you know, discussing priorities and the backlogs and stuff like that, then the customer would turn to me as a PO and not bother the devs. And I mean, we really respect the sprint, so we don't mess up the sprint. Once the sprint is started, the backlog is set, and they sprint.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's called sprinting.
Right.
So that doesn't really, we don't really have that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the positives are overweighing any negative impact.
Correct.
Mm.
Who is responsible for doing user research and market research? Is it you or is it the customer?
Well, responsible, that's a good question. I mean, user research, most of the times the customer doesn't have the skills to do that, so it's most of the time it's us doing that. So the UX designer in collaboration with the product owner, with the lead product owner.
Mm-hmm.
At some point we have actually done outsourcing, now that you talked about it before, for user testing, you know, really in a kind of a lab setting on an existing app where we wanted to figure out what's to be improved ergonomically and stuff like that, where, you know, where they filmed the participants and all that stuff. So there we used a company, so that wasn't us, but that just happened one time, else we do the research.
Because user research is a very... It's a very specific field. I mean, not necessarily as a developer, you will have understanding of the users or how to do research in that area. So
yeah, that's why it's the UX designers who do that. So maybe the term UX designer is encompassing more at Leap than it is at other companies. I don't know, but UX designer is not only here for designing user interface elements and things like that, and then the design itself. They do that as well, of course. But they also work on user research, on the vision and things like that.
So do you? I mean, the end users of your apps, are they globally distributed or are they limited to Swiss, EU?
Yeah, I have to think here a bit. I think mostly Swiss.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly Swiss. I we have done a couple of apps which aren't necessarily limited to the Swiss market, but it starts in the Swiss market.
The next question may not be now related or relevant for you, but how do you make assumptions about end users considering they are distributed? I don't think a user from Geneva would be different than a user from Zurich, but I don't know. But definitely a user from Japan would be different than a Swiss user.
Yeah, our customers come to us mostly. I have to think through the apps we've done here, scan them through. But so my feeling is the customers we have, or we've had at least, haven't come to us to build an international app, let's call it that way, right from the start. Mostly it's Swiss folks, like, I don't know if you know Fertig, that's a thing for the bus tickets, or you can just check in and it tracks you and then it buys the correct tickets and stuff like that. So that's, they have the ambition of going international, but they've started in Switzerland, so our customers were Swiss at that point, and they still are. Urban Connect or things like that. So we haven't been faced with the problem of the Japanese or the African
correct.
User at this point in time.
I mean, the challenges would be different in that case, right?
Yeah.
Under assuming what are their preferences.
How do we do that?
How would you end up doing that? So that's why I say it may not be relevant at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I probably can't really tell you. I mean,
but there will be some differences which
yeah.
you will have to tackle.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I guess we would try to really at that point say, sorry, we can't now start as Swiss persons start to imagine what the Japanese, how mm-hmm. he thinks and reacts. I guess we would really, really insist on having contact and having
mm-hmm.
real users involved
right.
at that point. I don't really see a way around. So, yeah. But that's hypothetical.
Right. Do you also collect non-functional requirements from the clients?
Yeah, not really in a formal way. Of course, they expect performance, they expect
performance.
Security,
mm-hmm.
But that's kind of a given.
Yeah. Do you think they have enough knowledge about these things, or it's more or less your thing?
Yeah. Yeah, that's our domain. I mean, we come across some customers who initially come and they have really unrealistic expectations about non-functional requirements.
Can you give me an example?
Well, like, you know, response times,
mm-hmm.
and so you have to build an app and it has to have a 1 millisecond response time for every screen and things like that, but it's a client-server
mm-hmm.
app. So then you have to explain to the customers that there's just no way you can guarantee that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there is, but that's a whole other world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. It's mostly response times, I guess, where they at some points are not realistic. But that's rather an exception.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just an expectation, you know, as it's so... it's such a part of our daily life, these mobile apps, people just expect that they work
right.
like the other apps.
Mm-hmm. So this is usually, and this is more or less about experience. So I mean, the non-functional requirements you don't have also. It's more or less, I think, now subconscious thing which you do by experience,
mm-hmm.
because you have done similar projects before and you know the loopholes where certain things fail. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
You already said you are doing prototypes and MVPs.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, what is your impression about them? How do you do it? We will talk about both of them differently because I got mixed reactions about MVP.
Mm-hmm.
But you do prototyping. How does it? I mean, do you do paper prototypes or you do really pixel perfect mockups and so on?
I mean, that can depend on the project, but
mm-hmm.
I don't think we do pixel perfect prototypes that often. It's more it can be paper prototypes. We've
mm-hmm.
done that. Where the problem, of course, is you have to, you know, manually simulate what's happening, so that's a bit of a hassle. So it doesn't really scale when you want to test on many people. And most of times we do clickable prototypes with InVision or things
InVision,
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it economical to build them? Does the customer pay for these things, or
they do pay? Often we don't really ask them if we should do that way. We just do it like that, and that's just.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of imposed because I know the discussions can be a bit hard, but I think it's economical. It's a good question. Is it really economical, or should one really go, you know, old school agile and say no, you develop and then you test the developed product and then you redevelop? Because a mobile app, native mobile app development as we do, is quite expensive compared to maybe web development. Where if you do a website or something, it's much faster to bring out something.
Mm-hmm.
Than in a native app,
mm-hmm.
where it's really, yeah, it's quite costly every time you develop something. So that's why we, in this domain, stick to clickable prototypes
mm-hmm.
as a first step to just validate ideas. And we wouldn't do it for, you know, for the whole thing. We do it where we see complexity
mm-hmm.
in the usability.
Right. About MVPs,
mm-hmm.
do you do MVPs?
Yeah.
What is the impression about them? Are they useful? Do they serve their purpose?
Yes, I think. Well, that depends on what you mean by their purpose. So, if the purpose, for me, the purpose of an MVP is to minimize risk very fast in the project.
Mm-hmm.
So you really focus on going end to end as fast as possible, or as quickly, as soon as possible, so that you know that whatever happens, in the worst case, you will have a product that fulfills the intention of the product. Mm-hmm. You won't have something that's really nice from A to B, but doesn't come to Z. So that's for me is the purpose, is to really instill the mindset of agile development in the whole team, including the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And the definition of MVP can also vary a bit. What do you mean by minimum viable product? And,
right.
and one should maybe talk about minimum marketable product. That can be a variant of an MVP.
Mm-hmm.
So,
because I'll give you some the reactions which I got. So people said it depends where you release your MVP.
Mm-hmm.
They said usually customers are very skeptical about MVPs because they see
for
that
the
product is not done,
mm-hmm.
and they're very skeptical to release it for the users.
Absolutely.
Because it gives the wrong impression of the product.
Yeah.
But if you are releasing only for the beta users, perhaps it is good.
That's absolutely true. They are very wary of the image that the app conveys,
mm-hmm.
because it's their brand image. So that's why they most of the times they wouldn't release a really you know, a hard MVP. If you really stick to MVP,
mm-hmm.
as you intend to, then it's probably not good enough for public release, because it's minimum viable in the sense of fulfilling the process, but it's not minimum viable if you take into account all the
mm-hmm.
other stuff, the branding, the image, and everything. That's why I sometimes talk about minimum marketable product, which then adds a couple of those things
right.
which you could do without, actually, if you just want to do what the thing is intended
mm-hmm.
to do, but which the company couldn't release without.
Right.
Mm.
But also, one of the companies, they said MVP is more of a startup thing. It's cool in startups,
mm-hmm.
but for them, because they are in business for 10 years, they say we don't do MVPs anymore,
mm-hmm.
because it just kills the spirit of the team, because you get kind of negative reactions from the customers.
Okay, we haven't
so
had that.
Mm-hmm.
No, we haven't had that. And again, it's important to be able to use the product as soon as possible, because often that's where you find out, oh, we didn't think about this, we didn't think
mm-hmm.
about that during requirements engineering. And oh, there is a stair to climb, and I've built a car. Oops. You know, you rather see there is a stair to climb after you build the skateboard than once
mm-hmm.
you finish the car. So it comes back to, I mean, for me, it's an integral part of the agile development, because
mm-hmm.
it's so often misunderstood how that works and what's the benefits of doing agile.
So it sounds like you have prototypes and you have MVPs and
mm-hmm.
you have the end product. Prototypes wouldn't become part of the end system, but MVPs will much more be the end systems, or they will evolve into the end systems, right?
Yeah.
I think that's already covered. So, could you give me a couple of examples which tools you use in general in the company for different purposes, like communication? You said Slack.
Okay. Yeah. Well, communication is Slack. Then the typical, Scrum tools. We have the Atlassian tools, so Confluence and Jira.
Yeah.
We share so for every customer and project we have a shared Confluence space.
Okay.
But
do
we also have our internal stuff.
Are they comfortable using Jira or Confluence?
Confluence not so much, but Jira, it's easy to use.
Does it get quickly messy because they end up opening a lot of tickets or anything like that?
No, actually not, because we really have this pair of the Leap PO and the customer PO working together,
mm-hmm.
and no, that doesn't really happen. No.
Okay, because I heard it from a couple of companies that their customers had access to Jira.
And they just opened tickets.
Open lots of tickets, which are also not relevant or tagged wrongly and so on.
Mm. Actually, no, because we really accompany the customer in the learning of the Scrum and Agile development.
Correct.
And that's also really fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I really emphasize on is not to pump the backlog, because having a too long backlog is just unmanageable.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, that's one real strong focus I set
mm-hmm.
with the customers, and keeping it neat.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned InVision for designing.
Yeah, InVision and Zeppelin for the InVision for the prototyping, and Zeppelin for the design, so that it can transfer to the developers in a good way,
mm-hmm.
and it that you can do it really well with Zeppelin. Then we have our own homebrew tool, which is really central here at Leap. It's called the Zebra, but it's at the moment it's not open sourced. We'll do that at some point. And that's ranging, that's really extremely broad. That's ranging from our internal peer reviews mm-hmm. for salary determination
okay.
to project budget management mm-hmm. and all that stuff. But that's in the custom projects, we use that for tracking. So we don't use the Jira sprint trackings. We have our own sprint trackings
okay.
and it communicates with Jira. And so it's completely integrated with
mm-hmm.
the budget tracking also.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What tools do we use as well as that?
I think it's good enough numbers. Yeah. Do you collect privacy requirements or security requirements as well?
Security requirements, not so much, as what we do are mostly apps in the App Store and stuff like that. So that's not really an issue there. I mean, security on the back end side is a given. I mean, we know we have to.
Do you have any exploits?
The people doing backends, they
usually
are
usually know.
Yeah,
the
they know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And but we have experts in the company which we can draw on if we really need.
Mm-hmm.
We have people who have expertise in many different domains, but also in security. What was I saying?
Privacy.
Privacy. Yeah, privacy is something we on every kickoff we mention it. We remind the customer about the privacy. We have to think about it, and even more now with
GDPR.
Yeah, it's. I think it's gotten more prominent since GDPR. And the funny thing is now customers are talking about it as if no Swiss law would exist prior to GDPR.
Right.
And they only focus on GDPR. That's interesting also. They don't care at all about the Swiss law.
Mm.
They only focus on GDPR. Now it's okay because GDPR is more stringent than
mm-hmm.
Swiss law at the moment, but that might change. But it mostly leads to just having, you know, a section with some legal documentation
right.
and things
how
like
do you
that.
How do you handle these situations? Because do you have any legal experts within the company, or do you outsource the legal work?
The legal work is actually, that's up to the customer too. If they want to do their like terms and conditions and all that stuff and privacy statements and stuff like that, then that's actually their
task.
To do. We have legal counsel here in Bern. Who is part-time working as product owner and part-time as legal,
mm-hmm.
is just the name of his role, but that's mostly regarding contracts. So
we also observe anything like the customer wanting to sign non-disclosure
yes,
agreement.
Yes, happens a lot. Yes.
So I heard this was very interesting for me. So those guys, they said customers are kind of, sometimes they have this feeling of urgency, or they have this feeling that the company will steal their idea, their super awesome idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing they want to do is sign NDA.
Yeah, we have really both experiences. We have exactly that, persons
and
who don't want to tell.
The consequences, they are not willing to give out the details.
Yeah.
So do you observe?
That happens, and at the point we've signed the NDA, we're quite liberal with signing NDA. We don't really have a problem with it. So if the customer wants to sign an NDA, then that's okay. But that really happens. The customer doesn't want to tell us like anything before we've signed an NDA. That's the most extreme. That doesn't happen. That's maybe 2 or 5% of times. And then maybe 30% of times, at some point they say they want an NDA. They tell us a bit about it, and then they say, so now would be the time to sign an NDA. And then we have the opposite. Customers who really are really open and even if it's novel ideas,
mm-hmm.
they openly talk with us about it, and they don't care about any NDAs. So both
that's the best case you have.
Yeah, well, actually, I don't really have a problem with NDA
mm-hmm.
because as
it's not the problem with NDAs itself,
mm-hmm.
but it's the fact that customers are not open to give you important details which are helpful for the development.
Yeah, actually, I don't know why, but that kind of doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
We really have a very, very transparent way of communicating with our customers, and I guess that kind of reflects in the other
mm-hmm.
way than back. And they appreciate that we really try to understand their business
mm-hmm.
First of all, before we
right.
do anything else. So we haven't had that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
at least not what I'm aware about. Might be that we had in other parts of the company. But yeah.
Great. So now we'll try to see and discuss more about how mobile development is or is at all different than software development in general.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think, are there any major differences between mobile development and software development? So you said one is it's costly.
Well, I mean, if you develop a business Java for enterprise app, then it's also costly.
Mm-hmm.
It's as much costly or even more than a native mm-hmm. mobile app. A native mobile app is more costly to develop per feature, if you want, than a JavaScript application, web application. So it's mm-hmm. somewhere in between, but it's not more costly than any other customer application development.
Mm-hmm. So do you see any other differences?
Well, the code base, as I said, is mostly smaller on the smallerish side, because you mostly don't want to have a mobile app which does thousands of different things. Mostly it's mm-hmm. it's really specific for a couple of tasks.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes the code base much smaller. You don't have these millions of lines of code bases in one app.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a difference. So the code ownership is easier to maintain, and also would be easier to transfer. If that's not really something we do. We try to keep the same teams on the same projects
mm-hmm.
for many, many years. And yeah, different in the sense of...
I'll also give you a couple of examples
mm-hmm.
what I've heard. The prototyping itself is much more extensive because you have different platforms which have different designs.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to do the prototypes. If you are doing pixel perfect prototypes, it's double work.
Yeah, that would be true. But as I said, we don't.
You don't do that.
No.
Other thing is testing is quite much more extensive in mobile apps.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is you have to do it on real devices,
mm-hmm.
and you have to test it on multiple devices,
yeah.
also multiple operating systems.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it has to be done manually because there is not much automation.
Yeah.
So the testing itself is also quite extensive in case of mobile apps.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The other point which I heard is when it comes to web applications, you can just deploy any hot fixes
mm-hmm.
or any bug fixes multiple times a day.
Exactly.
With mobile apps, you're kind of limited by app stores because they have their own workflows, they have their own checks.
Yeah. That's true, but it's gotten easier and faster. The main bottleneck there was actually the Apple Store more than the Google Play Store, where you had, sometimes you had to wait for more than a week for an app to be granted
right.
release. But that's not true anymore, since they don't do it only in Cupertino anymore. They have outsourced
mm-hmm.
that to India. And so that's true. And also, the thing is, with a web app, you access the front-end code. You download, basically, the front-end code
mm-hmm.
every time you access it. So it's much easier to roll out changes. You could do that very, very often. As if I would have to update, even if I don't have to do something manually, a mobile app a couple of times a week, it would annoy me. And I would probably deinstall it by some kind of funny reflex, because I always see, oh, this app again. That annoys me. And also you have this problem of you might be out of sync between backend and mobile app. Which
just because the user did not install the updates.
Exactly. So that's a challenge which you don't have on a web app, where you always are in sync, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's true.
Do you think non-functional requirements play a different role in case of mobile apps than web apps?
Play different roles? I don't know. I don't really think so.
So
well,
I got a funny reaction. I'm
mm-hmm.
not sure. So people contradicted with this also.
Mm-hmm.
But the original opinion, what he said is, when it comes to web applications, and if it is slow, the user usually ends up blaming the browser, or he assumes that
the
browser
or whatever,
or
yeah.
the connection.
Mm.
But when it comes to mobile apps, he
yeah.
thinks it's the developer's fault, or
mm-hmm.
it's the app which is not performing well.
That might be very true. I don't know, but
it sounds
very realistic. It
yeah.
sounds like I might think that as well. Even I might think that. And yeah, and also but I guess it comes also from the expectations which have been set. So
mm-hmm.
mobile apps are mostly very when they're done well, they're very reactive and very quick and things like that. And in the web, you come from this other side where it's actually always getting faster. And I don't know if you remember the beginnings where you had to look at the pictures loading like this.
Right.
So that's where we come from on the web. And on the mobile apps, we come from, you know, snappy apps. So that's the expectation is a different one. And people think it's a program on their phone and they don't really realize that there is back-end communication going on.
Yes,
so that's
right.
But on the web, you know it's that
right.
That's the way it is. So I think that's probably...
That's a valid kind
of
intuition.
I think so, yeah.
Do you think the elicitation process, the gathering process, it differs for mobile apps than the web apps?
It might be not because of technological aspects, but because what a web app or website is most of times, the things we do with the mobile apps is much more custom functional app development, whereas what we do on the website, even if we do web apps, we don't only do like display websites displaying stuff, but also really interactive stuff, it's still more standardized. It's still more having your content and maybe some functional aspects, but we don't build things like the Atlassian tools would be a good counter example. The Atlassian tools are web apps, but actually they're much more akin to mobile applications or any business application because they're really 100% functional. It's not a website.
Right.
Jira is not a website. But we have websites which also have functionality, but it's not the dominant part of the website. The website is mostly standardized because you have the information architecture is a different one because, again, on a mobile app, you don't try to do enormous things with a lot of navigation, a lot of information. That's probably not what you will have on a mobile app, whereas on the web side, you will have lots more of that. So I think that's why it differs a bit.
What, in your opinion, are the biggest challenges with the gathering requirements for mobile apps?
I don't know if it's for mobile apps. I think it's a general thing. It's really getting access
to the end users.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And and really, really developing in an agile way, like one should do, which means really having the users giving feedback or using the software while it's developed.
Do you also see any patterns that the customers, they are more focused or more sensitive about the design of the app than of mobile app than the web apps, that they are really picky about it?
No, I think maybe that's because of our image, but I think they expect... I mean, when you say design, do you think about really the looks and feel?
Also, because I heard that they are really sensitive about these things. They don't care really about functionality as such.
On the web? Or
on the mobile. In a sense, what they give you opinions more are about design. Because that's what they see and that's what they can understand.
No, I wouldn't agree on that, actually. Even though that happens as well. You know, you have important things and you have something in the workflow which doesn't make sense and you want to discuss about that and the customer talks about the color of the button or something.
Right.
That does happen, but it's not that's not predominant. I think our customers, they manage to focus on the functionality
as well.
Yeah.
We talked about it briefly, but app stores, Google Play or Apple App Store, they have their own checks for security, they have their own checks for design. Apple more intensive. Does it affect your gathering requirements, gathering process?
Not at all. No.
So in the sense, the question was something like this. So you're doing agile. The idea is that you are flexible to do for changes. But because app stores have certain policies, so you are careful while gathering certain requirements, or it doesn't happen?
No, it doesn't happen. It's more than when we engineer the solution or design the solution, maybe at some point, that we have to take that into consideration, but not when we gather requirements. Because for me, the requirements, they really need to be decoupled from the solution. The typical thing is you don't want to go to the users and ask them what do you need, and then you expect that they tell you about functionality. Because, I mean, it can be okay, but most of the times they won't come up with the optimal solution. And what we really need to understand is what is the problem we try to solve for the user. That's what we want to know.
Any decisions you make, do they depend on external factors such as operating system versions, external libraries, their versions?
Sometimes on operating system versions, because if the requirement from the one non-functional requirement from a customer would be it has to be really backwards compatible on Android, most really far back, then that might impose some constraints.
So that plays at least a certain role in while gathering requirements. So
now again, I don't think it's while gathering the requirements. I think it's once you have the requirements, and then you say, okay, now how do we respond to those requirements? That's when it plays a role, but not during the requirements gathering.
The customer
process.
Never says, I want to support last three versions of the operating system.
He can say, okay, well, maybe it's our definition of requirements gathering.
Because
I was thinking about the process where you then say, okay, what does the user want to do? What's his problem? What do you want to solve? Okay, what's the context? And how does he do it? And there, that's not the point where the customer would tell us, but hey, think about the customer might have an old Android version.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of things only happens like on a general level.
Mm-hmm.
They for some reason think that it's important that everybody can use the app.
Yep.
And then sometimes you also have to give them numbers and say, hey, look, that's like 1% of the users.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really think we need to put in all this effort to support Android 4.2?
Mm-hmm. One thing which I forgot when we were talking about the differences. So do you see in mobile apps it is much more prevalent that you cannot really foresee all the situations in which the app will be used?
Mm-hmm.
Because you have external factors such as network drops, offline content, or different locations and so on.
Well, we're kind of used to that
so
at this point.
This is what has evolved through your experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
But
I think initially it's true. Yeah.
Initially it's true, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever consider troubles that might be faced by special users, such as old people or blind people? So do you make any conscious decisions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's depending on the persona. So if we'd identify that while discussing the main persona of the app, then typically we would. I have something in my memories. I don't remember which app it was, but where it addressed older people more than younger people. So the size of the display and things like that would matter.
Right. I also heard for this, it was quite surprising. So he said it's a budgeting issue. In the sense, the customer knows that there will be 1% of the users will be old people, and he doesn't want to pay for these people. 1% of his users extra money for designing.
Well, I mean, it's an economical choice at that point.
App stores, they used to have very strange constraints, such as the number of methods you can have. So Android has this limit that you cannot have more than 60,000 methods in an app. Or they also had a limit on app size and how much content you can publish as external content or additional content, extra content. Have you ever met any such constraints? Or do you think they play any role?
That hasn't impacted our requirements, engineering, or design process at all until now.
But have you met these constraints at least, that the app was rejected by App Store?
I would have to ask the developers, and not that I'm aware of now.
Mm-hmm. So we are almost towards the end now. This is now like some rapid fire questions. So I'll give you one keyword, and you tell me if it is important for an app.
Okay.
Yeah, power consumption. I think you already said, but different mobile devices and different operating systems, it does play an important role. Third-party libraries and their versions.
Yes, but less.
Less?
Less than the other two.
mobile advertisements and revenue generation through them.
No, not in our cases.
Not in your cases. Even for free apps.
Yeah.
Great. This was interesting because I interviewed one Indian guy. They are providing services to US customers and so on.
Mm-hmm.
They said for free apps it is very much important for the customers, but in Switzerland I heard it from nobody.
Yeah.
So nobody, actually advertisements are, I think, annoying for people.
Mm-hmm.
And the business models work differently.
Exactly, they don't rely on advertisements.
Yeah. user feedback on app stores or any social media platforms?
Not enough. If it plays a role, that's the question. User feedback on app stores.
Do you ever go and check?
Yeah, sure, because we're curious, you know.
Right.
But
how?
Yeah, well, no, okay. Let's say it plays a role when suddenly you have a one star of somebody screaming out, or the app doesn't work. I'm skiing on the top of the mountain, and the app doesn't work. Yeah, sure, it doesn't work.
Yeah,
you know, that's when it gets important suddenly for the customer.
Mm-hmm.
But else, I don't think it's that relevant. And probably it's more relevant than once you have, you know, maybe an app with 100,000 or a million users than apps that we have, like where you have a smaller user base, because mostly you don't have that much reviews, and you know the first five are the team anyway, or the customer.
Right.
Yeah.
One thing which I missed before, do you do analytics as well for the apps?
Yeah, not as much as we would like to. That's again something we talk to the customer. We say, hey, it's important to build in analytics at the beginning, so we have the data and can make decisions based on. And it's always dropping down in the backlog. They always prioritize, you know, functional stuff before, so we don't do as much as we would like. But you have, I mean, the analytics of installations and all that stuff from the store. But the internal analytics, like, how does the user use the app? We don't do as much as we would like to.
Right.
We would like to do much more of that.
I had some questions regarding that, but I forgot. Anyway, last two questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to reflect you on these. So what are your impressions about hybrid apps?
we've abandoned hybrid apps.
Could you give me reasons why?
Quality of the end product.
So I'll also give you, I had very interesting discussions about these things, both opinions.
Mm-hmm.
But you first tell me, like, what are your thoughts?
Well, as I said, that if you really want a polished app, then you can't really get that with a hybrid app, as good as with a native app. Hybrid apps might be a bit cheaper to develop, but that's an impression more than a reality, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So often people come to us and say, well, we want to do a hybrid app. They have no technical expertise, but they think they need to do that because of costs.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really always true. And another factor driving us is also the skills of the team. For me, it's much more important that the development team uses the environment, language, tools, whatever, that they know and that they're proficient in, rather than something that the customers want to
impose. But you already are developing web applications, so...
But the developers we have in the mobile teams, they are all developers with, you know, Java backgrounds and things like that. So they like that environment, and they like, you know, the languages to be a bit more strict than JavaScript. They're not the JavaScript boys, the fanboys.
Mm-hmm.
And so all this hybrid or React Native or all those things are really good for people with that web background which want to step into mobile application development. But that's not the case of our developers. They come from the other side. They already like the strict language and the tooling. The pipelining is much better also for continuous integration and
in case
of native.
Native.
Yeah. So it's the environment, it's the IDEs, which are also preferred. And the polish you can get, and I mean, less and less of the technical possibilities would be an argument for native apps. That was an argument before. You knew, oh, you cannot do geolocation, or you cannot do this, you cannot do that. But as the browsers extend their capabilities to talk to the operating system, that fades away more and more, actually. So it's sometimes hard to argue for the case of native apps.
You said performance, so. One of the companies I interviewed,
and memory footprint. Yes.
Yeah. Mm. So they said they do exclusively hybrid apps now. They abandoned native apps.
Mm-hmm.
And he said performance is, it's just different. It's not necessarily worse. And usually the discussion about performance is done by tech guys. End users are not most of the time sophisticated to know these differences.
Mm.
So how would you react to that?
That's not our experience. Our experience in performance is not necessarily, you know, when you have to load data from the server. Well, that won't be more performant with a native app. It's really, you know, you click and in the millisecond, the reactiveness of the interface is, by our experience, not the same with hybrid apps as with native apps. And I mean, you're probably right, because I'm thinking of it right now. The developers, they see an app and they say, oh, that's a hybrid app, and I couldn't tell. I wouldn't know that's a hybrid app, but they somehow see, oh, that's a hybrid app, because they know some detail that I don't know. But I think you might be right there. I don't notice it, but the devs notice it.
It's an interesting point, because we really have a different view on it, because we see things differently than really the people on the street. Other point was, the negative point was, you already, when you do web development, you are kind of open to use anything you want. When it comes to mobile development, you are kind of limited by two big guys, which is Apple and Google. So you're already kind of dependent on these two guys. Building hybrid means you add one more layer of dependency on some other framework like Ionic or Facebook, React. So that plays a role.
That probably plays a role, and yeah, exactly. And I mean, maybe if you want to use some SDK, which maybe that's not available through those frameworks and things like that. So yeah, that's true. We also, by the way, we sometimes do Xamarin developments as well, but also less now than we used to. And that's also the same problem. You have one more constraint, and you have a lag of not being able to use the newest of the new, which would be a good point for a native app, is that as soon as a feature, a functionality, or a hardware feature is available, you can access it, while these other tools, Ionic and Code, they need to catch up, so they always lag a bit behind. But how often do you really need the newest thing?
Correct.
It's not really that often, actually.
Also, one thing is, it depends on the use cases. So if the app is just showing some information, it doesn't need any native features. Would it be economical and cheaper and practical to go for hybrid apps instead of...
Well, do you really need an app then? That's more the question. Or can you have a reactive, responsive website, which is really done well, that it really looks good?
That's where my next question comes. So what is your impression about progressive web apps?
Well, that's yet another thing.
Reactive
website, I mean really something that displays well on a mobile phone. And if you're talking about just displaying information, then do you really need an app at all? And then progressive web apps, we thought, that might be interesting. And again, this is the promise: you develop once, it works everywhere, but that's not true at all. You have it's true, but then when you practice it, you have to tweak endlessly. And you have to test, and then suddenly you've made changes, and suddenly it doesn't work on iOS anymore. And so it's really a hassle at the moment.
So it is not yet mature.
Sorry?
It is not yet so mature.
No, I don't think it's exactly. I think it's still immature, and the games promised in terms of development time aren't met.
Do you think in certain cases it can be useful, considering that you can very much bypass the app stores and their workflows?
Yeah, even though we don't have that much of problems with the app stores. So especially since Apple got faster, that was actually the main problem. At some times you have, but it's not that problematic, you know. Google changed some policy at some point, and suddenly we had a lot of apps where we had rejections because of the advertisement idea or something. And we didn't use it, but by default it was activated, you know. Small stuff like that, but that's a quick correction. You republish and it's done. So, no, I don't think that's a big issue. I don't think that's a big win for the progressive web apps.
Would you compare progressive web apps with hybrid apps? So, would for certain cases where you're going for hybrid apps because it's not using native features and it's just information displaying or newspaper kind of website.
Yeah, well then do a progressive web app in that case, yeah.
So in that case, it is more practical to go with progressive web apps than...
But it's probably even more practical to just have your website responding well to a mobile display, and then maybe, you know, putting in a link or something to put the icon on the desktop because you can do that. Actually,
I think the reason behind not having a website being responsive is very less times I think users go to mobile browsers to open a website.
Mm-hmm.
They are just not used to it. They just prefer an icon which they can click and something opens.
But you can do that with a website. I mean, you can put an icon of any website. You can have a URL link and as an icon on your homepage. It doesn't have to be a progressive web app.
How many people are aware of
Nobody
that?
Nobody knows that.
Correct.
But you can use JavaScript to mm-hmm. To make a call for action on your website. But you have to have been on that website, of course, first.
Right.
But the same is true with a progressive web app. So. And the argument about the web the stores, you know, oh, it's a marketing channel to be on the stores is, I guess, less and less true, because it was true. I always bring up the story. The fourth, one of the four first apps that ever came out for iOS was a completely useless app. You would see a pond from above. It was really nice looking, and you could bother the fishes with your fingers, and the water would react, and the fishes would get all messed up. But that was all it was doing. So it had no use, and the guys made $1 million with it because it cost, I think, $1 to buy, and it was one of the four first apps you could ever install on your phone.
Right.
So then it was really a major advantage to be on the store. Now you have millions and millions of apps, and you have the same problem as on the web. Discovery is the problem now. So just being on the store is not an argument anymore for doing an app instead of having a website, because you're completely lost in these stores.
So I have some statistics here, because you said that. So Apple App Store or Google Play, they came into existence around 2007.
Mm-hmm.
In about 10 years, around 2017, there were 2 million apps
mm-hmm.
on App Store.
Yeah.
And the second figure was around 170 billion apps were downloaded from different platforms in the same year. The second figure seems a bit fishy,
yeah,
but the standard figures, considering it true, so you have already in 10 years you have billions of apps, and if you ask a common person on the street how many apps do you have on your mobile, it wouldn't maybe exceed than 20.
Yeah.
So what happens to these billions
exactly
of apps?
Exactly, yeah. So, so you have exactly the same problem. So before you become an icon on the home screen of